Good morning. I'm Frank Kaufman. I'm the president of the 12 Gates Foundation. We're very fortunate to have on our program this morning Dr. Alon Ben-Meir. Dr. Ben-Meir is a former professor at New York University's Center for Global Affairs and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. Dr. Ben-Meir is an expert on Middle East and West Balkan affairs, international negotiations, and conflict resolution. In the past two decades, Professor Ben-Meir has been directly involved in various back-channel negotiations involving Israel and its neighboring countries and Turkey. Dr. Ben-Meir is featured on a variety of television networks and also regularly briefs at the U.S. State Department for International Visitors programs. He writes a weekly article that is syndicated globally. Dr. Ben-Meir has authored seven books related to the Middle East and is currently working on two new books about Syria and Turkey. Dr. Ben-Meir holds a master's degree in philosophy and a doctorate in international relations from Oxford University. He can be found on Facebook and on Twitter, and those links for his identity on these platforms can be found in the notes together with this interview. Dr. Ben-Meir, we're really excited to have you. Thank you for being with us today. Professor, thank you very much for coming on. We're very fortunate to have you with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Frank, for having me. It is truly my pleasure.
Thank you. I know you have a big event coming off. You're coming up. You're taking off for a week or more for some serious work on a project. I hope we may be able to learn a little bit about that. I have been studying some of your recent writing and proposals. It seems to me that you've forged the notion of an Israeli-Palestinian confederation as somewhat of a modification or augmentation of your lifelong advocacy for a harmonious two-state solution in the Holy Land.
Right.
What I've been studying of yours lately, is that related to the work you have coming up?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I've been involved in and writing about. And the project itself will be probably done in about 3 weeks. That is the entire proposal. We have a first draft, but I'm just going to over the second, third draft now. So it will be completely done, yes.
Wonderful. From your bio, it seems like you are frequently brought in as a subject matter expert among actual policy-making events. It isn't just academic publication you're involved in. Is that true?
Yes, behind the scene. I mean, it is not that I talk about openly publicly, but I'm often being asked my views on various conflicting issues. My field, as you know, it's international negotiations and conflict resolution. I'm not going to claim too many successes in conflict resolution. But in fact, I have, however, been advised various players as to what it might take.
Very good. I think it may be in large part because you're consistently moderate, you're consistently irenic, you're not virulent, very clearly for peace itself, not for a particular side in a conflict. It's a very remarkable and satisfying part of keeping up with your writing and your work.
You know, I've always maintained, and mind you, I just want to say, when I my dissertation, PhD dissertation, as a matter of fact, I hate to tell you how long ago, nearly 40 years.
It was
on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I published it as a book called Imperative and Choices. And in that book, when going on 40 years, I advocated that and said time and again that the solution to Israeli-Palestinian conflict rests on a two-state solution. That is, no matter almost what transpires, from my perspective, I don't believe, I never believe that the Palestinian will ever give up on their right for a Palestinian statehood. Mm. That is my absolute belief. What has changed is not the fact that they should have a Palestinian state in order to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the question is, given what has changed on the ground for the last 30 years or so, can that be possible? Can you, in fact, have totally and completely two separate states with no some kind of formal collaboration, cooperation between the two sides?
Yes.
And I depict, you know, five different elements that demonstrate that it is impossible, in my view, to have a two-state solution unless they are connected in one form or another under the framework of confederation. And if I may, I can explain to you briefly the various. Let me explain one point at a time. Perhaps you can ask me questions about it, and then I go to the second point. So there are five points that demonstrate that the two sides can reach an agreement based on a two-state solution. But what happened on the ground that makes that necessitate the creation of confederation? Let me start with the interspersed population of the Israelis and Palestinians. And what you have today, you have nearly 2,800,000 Palestinians in the West Bank. And there are 400,000 Israelis living in the West Bank itself and over 120 settlements. Then you have Jerusalem, in Jerusalem itself, you have 330,000 Palestinians and some 215,000 Israelis. So what you have here, the intermingling of the population, this is something that, in my view, cannot and will not be reversed under any circumstances, which means Israel may evacuate a few settlements here and there, but the bulk of the Israelis, specifically the three blocks along the Israeli border and many of the settlements, including, say, Ariel and others, cannot and will not be evacuated, which means that interdispersed population in the West Bank, it is not something that can be reversed. The same thing, in fact, even with a greater intensity, is the situation in Jerusalem. You know, as a matter of fact, from my perspective, Jerusalem has represented a microcosm of Israeli-Palestinian coexistence. And to this day, of course, the Palestinians in Jerusalem can move all over Jerusalem itself, east and west, and certainly even all over Israel. But they are Palestinians, not Israeli Palestinians. They don't have the right to vote or be elected in Israel itself. So this is a fact. Then you have in Israel itself, you have nearly 1,800,000 Israelis. They are Israeli citizens. And they're certainly not going anywhere either. And then you have the Gaza. Although there's no intermingling of population in Gaza, but you have 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who depend on Israel for so many different things today, even under the current circumstances. And under conditions of peace, the Palestinian will still have to have very close connection, relationship between Israel and Gaza. And specifically, if the Palestinian in the West Bank and Gaza eventually can get together, and they're going to have also passes through Israel, without which will be basically impossible. What I'm saying then, the interdispersed population between the two sides is a fact that cannot be reversed. And I have challenged many people to tell me, how can you in fact separate the population? It cannot be separated. That one major factor led me to believe that as a result of this, any future border may be hard border today, but under conditions of peace, that border cannot be hard anymore. It will be basically a political border once they agree on the contour of the Palestinian state. Where are the lines going to be drawn? So initially, there's going to be a continuing hard border, Later on, it's going to become basically a political border. That is, once everything else is in place. That's one point. So if you want to ask me about it, I'll elaborate before I move to the next one.
Okay. I have to say, before moving into the specific first element of interdisbursement of populations, that as I studied this work and this proposal for two states built on the concept of confederation, I have to say that I myself personally have been moved far along the chart, or the needle moved far toward a greater appreciation of two state reading this, because a lot of the difficulties you address in this proposal for confederation were things that struck me as untenable in classical two-state solutions. So I'm quite inspired by this, and I'm kind of a doubter. So you have a little bit of a convert here.
Thank you.
As much of a doubter.
It says a lot, Frank. It says a lot to me, really.
Yeah. And so I love the honesty, just in this first point, the honesty by saying, we'll never be able to extricate or remove or separate the populations that are already interdispersed in. That's a great starting point in my reckoning, or in my personal appreciation of the vision of what you're presenting here. So maybe a question I can ask is, just for the sake of readers' information or greater sense of nuance, can you tell us a little bit about how Israeli Arab citizens are viewed by Arab friends of the Palestinians and groups in Palestine itself? How are they viewed? Let me just give an example. I know that a certain type of Jew that considers it a religious obligation to do Aliyah occasionally will find the American Jews, they'll be critical of them. Why aren't you coming to support the vision, you know, the dispensation of God, something like that. So I'm wondering if the Israeli Arab citizens, how are they viewed by some of the traditionally more hardline or more separatist communities in the Arab world and in the Palestinian areas?
Well, I think it's a very important question that you're asking. That is, the Israeli Palestinian, Israeli Arabs, obviously, they're full-fledged citizens.
Yes.
But there is no question that there is considerable discrimination against them. I mean, this is not a secret. It's almost basically it's on the open. However, regardless of that, if you were to ask them would they want to leave and go to elsewhere, they will tell you absolutely not, because they still enjoy certain rights, significant human rights, and the freedom of movement in Israel itself, which is in many countries, many even Arab countries, sometimes they will not be able to enjoy that much of a freedom. Mm-hmm. That said, their affinity, and this is very important to keep in mind, their affinity to their brethren in the West Bank, in Gaza, and elsewhere, refugees in Lebanon, is very, very powerful and very strong. I just think remind you of what happened only a couple of months ago when there was a conflict between Hamas and Israel. There was clashes between Israeli Arabs and Israeli citizens, not just the police, but Israeli Jews. Mm. And that was a clear demonstration. That is, when they feel that their brothers, that is, in the West Bank, other Palestinians are being abused by Israel, they absolutely will demonstrate, ready to demonstrate where the affinity lies. And that's very important to keep in mind. And that will not change, even under condition, under any circumstances, because blood, like the old saying goes, is thicker than water. And that is just a fact of life. And the Israelis always keep that in mind. That is, if they do not settle with the Palestinian in the West Bank, in Gaza and elsewhere, and the hatred and animosity continues, what basically Israel will be doing is creating a fifth column in Israel itself. That is an extraordinary dangerous for Israel. That is, you could end up under massive or a great conflagration between the two sides. You could end up with very significant, almost civil war in Israel itself. And that's something that everybody has to keep in mind. And a little, a taste of that, as I said earlier, was felt only a couple of months ago when they openly went out, demonstrated, and was significant clashes between Israeli, Palestinian, and Israeli Jews.
Very interesting. Very helpful. That's helpful. Historically speaking, given that the Israeli Arab citizens benefit from some of the elegance and democratic commitments that in Israel might be superior to other places they might live, have Israeli Arab citizens been particularly helpful in negotiations? Are they used as a mediating force? Do they rise up to help each side understand the other a little better in either private conversations or peace meetings? And
nothing formally. Obviously, they'll be talking behind the scenes, but I don't think in an official capacity. Israel did not single out or to lean on any leader Palestinian within Israel itself to do anything about it. Because from their perspective, they are Israeli citizens. That is, Israel basically used the Palestinian, the Israeli citizen, the Arab citizen in Israel, as citizen, albeit they do not want to have any formal relationship, just like they won't have formal relationship between the Jews in Israel and the Palestinians in terms of, you know, when we talk about the peace and reconciliation. So there was very little, if any, formal connection between Israeli Arabs and the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
I see.
Yeah, that is, Israel never asked or did not. That kind of connection is not there, other than, of course, like I said, a strong affinity, but they have not been a conduit for any political objectives.
I see. Okay. Do they ever suffer from being suspected as not enough of an ally? Why are you over there? You don't really know our situation. You're living too easily. Or do they ever suffer from their own side of family and friends in the Arab world, those that are the Israeli citizens?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly rumbling of that. I mean, some Palestinian extremists even call them traitors. Because they're basically enjoying the so-called much better life. But there is that kind of rumblings going on. But it is not serious enough to create an open conflict between the two sides.
Very good. Okay. These are a little bit random questions on my part, but I hope I've added a little bit to this issue, the first one of your five. And
yes. And I appreciate that. The second point I want to discuss is Jerusalem. And when you look at Jerusalem today, from the day that Israel occupied the east side of Jerusalem, Israel immediately annexed that part pretty much, and then made the greater Jerusalem as Israel capital. But the fact that other than the mingling of the population, you have the holy site, the Jewish holy site, as well as the Arab holy site, the Aqsa Mosque with the Dome of the Rock, obviously, and the Wailing Wall in Israel, which is the outer wall of the Second Temple. This will not change. That's another factor that nobody can change, sort of catastrophic religious war. That means the two sides are juxtaposed to one another. This is a fact. It has been a fact this way for millennia, and it's going to continue to be this way, which means the level of cooperation between the two sides on this, in terms of from a religious perspective, is an absolute must. Jordan has been the custodian, or it still is the custodian of the Muslim holy site in Jerusalem. That is not going to change. Hence, we can talk a little later about Jordan is certainly will have to be a part and parcel of Israeli-Palestinian Confederation. So here what you have is a situation in Jerusalem where Israel is going to maintain its control over its holy site under any circumstances. Israel will never give up that. And the Palestinian and the Arab world will never give up their right or their control over the holy site there, which means in the future, both then need to cooperate in terms of excavation, in terms of tourism, in terms of employment, in terms of development, because neither side can do it on their own. So that is another factor that's going to require significant collaboration between the two sides, no matter what is the political outcome is going to be in terms of who has a stake. That is the second point that we need to keep in mind. And I'll stop here if you have any questions.
Okay. Very good. The first point was the interdisbursement of population. Second point is Jerusalem itself. And it seems here too, I'm starting to see a trend. Why I have been endeared to or drawn to this proposal is it's starting in an honest place. That bodes well and is promising. As I was reading on your section on this issue of Jerusalem, you talked about, and I hope you recall this, I'm sure you must, you talked about East and West Jerusalem being independent municipalities with their own laws and administrations. Do you recall that part of your...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. And then you described a joint Israeli-Palestinian commission covering the entirety of Jerusalem must also be established.
Yes.
Okay. What I felt or wondered as I read about this is that this would be a particularly difficult thing to put in place. The laws and administrations will reflect, especially, well, I don't even want to say especially on the Muslim side, but they will reflect the religion and culture and concept of law by which people are expected to live in daily civic and civilian life. The laws will be quite different, and the highest appeal would naturally be ultimately the spiritual, religious, kind of the cultural roots of why these are laws over our people in their daily lives. And so I thought a higher commission is, it has to be almost more secular, or what are its laws? I can't see laws that are grounded in religious culture subsuming themselves voluntarily or willingly under a higher administration or a secular higher third.
The characterization of being a higher is not exactly what I have in mind. The commission is not to intervene in the internal affairs of either side. That is, the commission, the purpose is if there's any issues. For example, somebody committed a crime, a Palestinian committed a crime in West Jerusalem, and he escaped to the East Jurusalem. Who will have a jurisdiction to chase or to try to apprehend such an individual? That is, the commission is to deal with conflicting issues as they arise, or joint project by choice. They are not interfering with the religious issue, because that would have been subtle under the conditions of peace. They are not going to interfere in anything that's happened with the East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem in terms of their involvement. They are involved only when there is conflict between the two sides that may arise, so that together they can resolve it. Specifically because you do not have a hard border, and you will never have a border in Jerusalem itself. That is, Jerusalem will never be divided again. I can tell you this categorically, not because the Israelis were not divided, because the Palestinians themselves don't want to see that kind of physical division. And when you don't have a physical division, and when people can move freely between the two sides, some issues could arise, some problem could arise, and then they need a joint commission that can actually settle these kind of issues between the two sides. Crime is one. Some joint development programs, some repairs, roads, stuff like that, where the two are impacted upon. That's where the commission get involved.
Very good. I understand. It sounds to me like that's going to be one of the real challenging elements of the proposal. Do you agree it's going to be especially challenging, or no? Do you?
Well, it's the question is, you know, to what extent actually they are going to go for the confederation, and then when they do that, they will realize the facts on the ground will necessitate that if Jerusalem is going to remain united physically, albeit with two municipalities, there's got to be some level of significant cooperation between the two sides.
Yeah.
Yes, and then you need some kind of commission of civilian representing both sides. And both sides are represented at this commission, and they will be able to deal with, as I said, issues that may arise that impact on both sides.
Very good. And if I recall, you recommend that there may be, or in your proposal, that there will be alternating heads of the commission by some agreed term limit or something like that.
This is something they can fashion themselves. I would be presumptuous to suggest this is exactly how it's going to happen. What I'm suggesting is that the body need to be created, and the working of the body is going to have all to be obviously agreed upon by mutual consent. They'll have a mutual consent about it. Would that be very easy, smooth sailing? I'm not going to say that's going to be smooth sailing. No. But is it doable? Is it necessary? In fact, is it a must? The answer to that is yes, from my perspective.
Very good. Very good. Well, good. Since we have a short time, thank you for that section. I'm looking forward to hear what's going to be your third.
The third one is security. Here, too, the two sides can no longer separate their national security concern. Even today, Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank collaborate day in and day out on all security matters. There'll be no condition under which, if there's two separate states, that collaboration will cede, will stop, because Israel will always be concerned over its national security, specifically, you say, when it comes to the Jordan Valley, or the day-to-day between, given living together. There's always a question of national security, which means the collaboration here is not temporary. It exists today. It will have to continue to exist tomorrow. And the both sides have been and will continue to collaborate and cooperate together. That is not going to stop. Certainly when Jordan become part of that process, Jordan is already involved very much so in all security matters between Israel and Jordan, just the same. So as we look at the conditions today, the three parties are very much involved in security matters to prevent terrorism, to prevent smuggling of weapons, these conditions cannot change. That is, the Palestinian state will be obviously demilitarized, but they will have significant internal domestic force that work hand in hand with the Israelis. And that is will be good for both sides, because both sides want to protect their national security concern, not necessarily from one another once there is peace, but from elements, extremist elements, be that Israelis and Palestinians, who would not like to see that happening, and they will remain determined to disrupt whatever they can and even resort to violence. That's why that collaboration is necessary. It exists today. It will have to continue to exist for as far as the eye can see, but however, further augmented to meet the requirement of tomorrow's.
Very good. I have a number of questions on this issue of security. I'll try to get through them quickly. The simplest one, and I think you've already addressed that just now in the latter part of what you've just described. The simplest one has to do with security involves intelligence, and intelligence is one of the coins of self-protection and intelligence sharing or of sharing on some security concerns. It's a modified relationship that you can't share everything, or especially with someone who's not a deep ally to your own cause. If there's a tense relationship, the idea of intelligence sharing and security sharing, can you speak to that at all? Did I express my question clearly enough?
Absolutely. I think today I can tell you I know firsthand. There's considerable amount of intelligence sharing between the two sides, and because it serves their purpose. The Palestinian Authority does not want, violent action are taking place, limited some terrorist activities are taking place, but without the sharing of intelligence between the two sides, and without the full collaboration on security matter, the situation would have been totally different. But answering your question, can Israel share every single thing? Not necessarily, but Israel will share enough to prevent any terrorist attack. The Palestinians, to serve their own interests, will share enough, all the intelligence they can, in order to maintain the tranquility and to maintain an undisturbed status quo. That is in their best interest. Hence, they are sharing all the necessary intelligence to maintain calm and to prevent outside extremist elements from, as I said, undermining any kind of an agreement between the two sides.
Very good. The next question I have is you said that the Palestinian state must be demilitarized as a necessary condition to advance along the lines of this proposal. But what about elements of this state or any state that is quasi, it's not government, it's not militarized, it's not the formal military of the government, but there are, even the U.S. has this problem, there are military or paramilitary or quasi-government or sanctioned, there's groups that involve themselves in trade of military gear, they function militarily, they do military type things, even if a state would be described as demilitarized. What about those elements that are very strong within the state that have military designs or purposes or may not be consonant with these efforts for peace and confederation?
Well, as you look at the situation today, the Palestinians have significant security apparatus. And to maintain calm in the West Bank itself, as well as to ensure that there will be no significant violent conflict with Israel. So they have that force. That force can be augmented and be strengthened. But to have a military that is in a classic sense, what military? The Palestinians would have really no enemies that is going to threaten them. And even if they have the any kind of military they can establish, the cost notwithstanding, which is astronomical, who they can fight with the military, Israel will remain the superpower in the region, not to speak only against the Palestinians. So to have a military that is going to be basically useless, to spend billions of dollars to establish, right, when you have also no enemy actually threatening you as a state,
right,
completely unnecessary.
Right. Okay. On that line, I understand very well. That makes perfect sense. The final question I'll ask, or maybe penultimate, but is in your discussion of introducing this aspect of security in your 5-point proposal, you go into a brief line or two about the second intifada in 2000, in which, following the failed peace negotiations at Camp David, which Israel conducted in good faith, and then a couple of lines later you say, there's a notion among multitude of Israelis that the Palestinians can never be trusted. How will this be transcended or resolved or overcome in order to get to some of the implementation of some of what you recommend here?
This is very important. And this actually, the answer to the question occupies a significant part, which you haven't seen. That's why when I said earlier, mm-hmm. that is going to be completed. And that is, I call, a process of reconciliation. That is, given the animosity that exists today, the hatred, the concern, the suspicion between the two sides, the second intifada basically awakened most Israelis to the fact to thinking that the Palestinian, and for good reason at the time, can never be trusted, because particularly because the second intifada followed almost immediately the failure at Camp David, when Israel, in fact, Ehud Barak at the time, the former prime minister, agreed to establish a Palestinian state. There was almost 90% of the issues being resolved at Camp David. But that's, without going into that, what I'm saying is, as far as the this framework that I'm suggesting, given that what happened, given the distrust, specifically the distrust and the hatred between the two sides, you're going to need a process of reconciliation before you actually can establish a confederation. What is this process of reconciliation? I think we need about 5, perhaps to 7 years, people to people and government to government. That is, Israelis and the Palestinians will mingle, will be together in sport activities, art displays, visitation both sides. That is, the people need to know how each other is living. This is the process of reconciliation and working on many, many civilian, small, large projects together. Government to government, there's so much that the two sides can do in terms of the schooling, changing the public narrative. It's very important. Ending acrimonious narrative. That is, this process basically prepared both sides, Israelis and the Palestinian, that eventually they realize they coexist today. They have no choice but to coexist tomorrow. Then the question becomes for both sides, how do we want to coexist? Do we want to continue to kill each other for another 73 years? Or do we have to accept the fact that we coexist and peaceful coexistence is the only practical solution that's going to allow both people to grow and prosper together?
Yes.
And so the process of reconciliation precedes the establishment of the Confederation. However, the agreement on the Confederation need to be established from the beginning, because the Palestinian will not simply say, let's normalize everything else and let's see what happens in the future. They need to know that in the end of the road, a Palestinian state would be created.
I see. Okay, very good. So a big part of your recommendation and proposal includes this 5 to 7 year period of reconciliation and the details and the broad strokes of the framework of a two state with confederation elements or structures and dynamics that needs to be there on the front end of the 5 to 7 year process, so that the Palestinians can trust that the trust building and the softening of relations and starting to feel more shared destiny and future as people living in the same region, they'll know their state is not guaranteed, but it is toward the establishment of their state, which is irremovable from the mind of the Palestinians.
That is correct. And, we probably won't have much time to talk about the role of the United States, the role of the Arab state, the role of the EU in this regard. But there's no question that they are very much involved in this process as well. So that everybody, the Palestinian in particular, feel this is not something that Israel promised to do so, but the framework is also fully supported by the United States. And there's a section, a fairly large section, that actually addresses the role of the United States in order to ensure that this process of reconciliation continues. But mind you, which is both sides agree under any circumstances, improved relations between the two sides is desirable almost under any conditions.
Correct.
That's what they want. So there's nothing in the process of reconciliation that's going to take anything away from either side. In fact, it's going to only augment and ensure that both sides begin to see each other, not as enemy, but the future friend, our neighbors. They're going to collaborate and cooperate and transact and trade and visit together. That is going to have to be the end result.
Yes.
And if when I ask people today, that is there any problem in going through such a process, regardless, basically, even after our ultimate outcome, they say, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, even the current Israeli government under Bennett, who's an extremist to the right, one of the things they want to do is they call, let's shrink the occupation. What does it mean, shrink the occupation? Give the Palestinian more opportunities involved. Give them more little leeway. Obviously, Bennett and he's openly against the creation of a Palestinian state, but he also understands the current status quo is not sustainable. A process of final reconciliation ought to take place in order to keep the lid on potential explosion. That's the idea. So process of reconciliation is a very much integral part of this plan. And you will have very little resistance to start such a process, because everybody would like to see more calm and less conflict and less violence.
Yes. Well, as we're speaking, Professor, what crossed my mind is that there's two, but actually three elements of your proposal. We've run out of time. The last thing I want to do is race through anything you've said, because it's all very carefully thought out and well expressed. And so I thought, maybe we can shoot for a part one, part two. We've covered the first three elements, although in an abridged way of your proposal. There's two more to go. And in addition to that, there is the distinct and unique commendations within your 5 to 7 year reconciliation preface to the whole concept of the confederated two states.
That's right. And also, in addition to that, with some specificity in terms of what the role of the U.S. should be, what the role of the Arab state, specifically Saudi Arabia, should be, with which I talked regularly about it. And the role, of course, of the EU, who's been supportive of a two-state solution from day one and continue to support it to the hilt. And so we can also talk about that in segment two, if you wish.
Beautiful. That would be fantastic, especially for the European and American audiences among us. So if you don't mind, if we can count on a part two, then we won't feel rushed. I think we've learned a lot so far, and this has been fantastic. It's been an eye-opener for me, and I really enjoy your clarity and ease of to grasp complicated matters with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Frank. I appreciate it.
Good. So I will work with your staff to see if we can put together at least the second part of this, because there's much else that is of extreme value in what you've put together. And maybe with that, we can just thank heaven above that our time and our tech went well and that we've learned a lot until this juncture so far.
Thank you. Thank you. It's entirely up to you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. We'll work it out, but this has been great. I'm really thankful for your time, Professor.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to do that with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye for now.
All the best. Thank you again. Bye-bye.